Master, or rather Nikki, thank you so much for that, and welcome everybody this evening. I'm enormously flattered to see so many people, many of whom have not yet had the misfortune of listening to me speak in public before, turn up this evening to hear me talk on this particular topic. I was asked earlier on today whether I felt nervous about this task. Well, the answer is, of course, yes, because I flatter myself that the day I don't feel nervous about this sort of thing will be the first day I really, really bomb in public. But the real reason I was nervous tonight had a special frisson, because Nikki had sent me a, "Ken, we're really looking forward to seeing you speaking this week" note earlier in the week. And she said, "Of course, we're looking forward to you staying on for some drinks and dinner afterwards. Very nice. The master's lodge is at your disposal for you and Julia to take a rest when you get here. Would you like us to leave you cake and tea or just tea?" This is the kind of dialogue I always hope to have with the masters of Cambridge colleges. And then the next line was, "Oh, by the way, I've enjoyed reading your college tutors and supervisors' notes." So for the rest of the last 72 hours, I've been sweating on what on earth you're going to draw out of them. So thank you for managing to find so many flattering things to say. And I think I possibly owe you rather a lot for that. My job tonight is to share with you some of the, I can only say extreme experiences that I've had in the last 5 years. And you will have seen from the flyer that drew you all here this evening some flavour of what I was going to be talking about. But if I just take you back 3 years, I find myself in a very strange position. As Nikki has hinted, I was on the board of the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, helping sort out MPs' expenses, about which more later. I was on the board of Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation, a FTSE 50 massive mining concern in ferrochrome and aluminium in particular. And I was the master of my livery company. And I thought for my topic, as the master of the livery company, at the enormous banquet that is the privilege of each master each year, in Mansion House, joined by the Lord Mayor, his wife, the two sheriffs, their partners, and another 250 close friends, I answered three questions. One, are you enjoying yourself as a master of a livery company? Whereas I was obviously with a red nose and slightly drunk, clearly enjoying myself enormously. Secondly, what on earth made you step up and allow yourself to join the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, IPSA, and so become hated by all members of Parliament for all time? And thirdly, are you not suicidal or at least certifiable by having joined the board of a Kazakhstan-based mining company? And I answered the three questions. Yes, I'm enjoying myself as a master. No, I think there's a public duty involved with things like IPSA, and they need to be sorted out. And we have to attract large numbers of foreign companies to list in London if London is to maintain, City of London is to maintain its standing. So I said all that lot. It went down rather well, I have to say. I was feeling very pleased with myself. And I said, as my denouement of the point, and of course, if people like us don't do these things, who will? And 220 people simultaneously went, "Well, not me." Well, what I'm going to tell you for the next 40 minutes or so is why they might be right, but if they are, and we allow that position to sustain, it has dire consequences for us here in the UK, actually in the democratic world. And I'll summarise what I want to say to you tonight, which is to say, in a democracy, I think every citizen has a responsibility to participate, and we must participate in one of two ways. We either become a politician, or we just nag the bejabers out of the ones who have become politicians. And I'm going to focus on the latter tonight and give you some clues on how to deal with those people in power in the city and in Westminster. Having said that nagging or joining them are the only two options, or is the only option, the only alternatives, a couple of weeks ago, had a stab at joining them, and I ran unsuccessfully for elected office in the City of London in the Farringdon Within ward. I believe I've broken a record by being the first ever candidate in a city election to wear a rosette. The city is a place of tradition, and it moves very slowly. I was roundly beaten by somebody who had 4 years run-up to the role before the 3 weeks that my team had. But we scored such an enormous number of votes that we scared the bejabers out of the man who subsequently won. And on that wonderfully rainy weekend in October, which you will all remember with the storms raging everywhere, whilst I was at home with my family enjoying myself, he, having thought it was a shoo-in, spent the whole weekend knocking on the doors of strangers, asking them to vote for him. So at least I had an effect, and he and I have now become quite close because I'm nice in defeat, although unused to it. Now, what I want to say is that experience of walking around the city, talking to businesses and to residents, and asking them to vote for me was humbling, particularly disappointing as I failed, but was humbling, but also it exposed the gap that exists between the electors and the elected in our country and in many other countries. It was a very mild experience for me, talking to business people in that context and residents, but it's not that long, remember, that the anger of the electors against the elected manifested itself in the Occupy movements around the world and epitomised the gap between the elected and the electors. Now, it wasn't as dramatic here, of course, as it was in North Africa, and it rumbles on significantly there, where the gap was much greater. But that gap is a significant gap. And the gap, I think, the bridge of the gap, is something fundamental to human relationships, and that is trust. And when trust breaks down, the gap gets bigger. And when trust is there, the gap gets smaller. So guess what? In times of national emergency, for example, a war, the gap gets much narrower because everybody has a common objective. And when that doesn't happen and the elected think that they can run Riley, life of Riley, it gets much greater. And this whole palaver of the Occupy London and other places movement was an outpouring of that kind of anger in a civilized and relatively comfortable society. The definition of trust is easy. We all know what it means. It's basically faith or confidence in the strength of another, of the argument, of the commitment of another person. But the scale of that gap that I'm talking about in the UK isn't just an opinion of mine. It's a fact. This is an Ipsos Mori poll, which shows the enormous gap of expectations between the elected and the electors, what we expect them to do. So the top bar there shows the public's view on whether MPs put, well, what do they put as their primary interest? You'd like to think a Member of Parliament is here to support the people, so you'd want the countries or their constituents, which is the rightmost two colours there, or the middle two colours rather there. And as you can see, actually their own and their parties account for 83% of people's understanding what MPs are doing. That, I think, is a dangerous gap. It's not as dangerous as North Africa, but it's a dangerous gap. But it's not just about politicians. It's about business leaders too. And as a proxy for the general view about business in the UK and the arguments about energy prices more recently, we'll do as a reminder of the anger that customers feel about the system. This is a poll from YouGov earlier this year, March this year, looking at banks and what motivates bankers. And all you need to do is look at the top left-hand corner, which says, for those who perhaps with a small print, bankers are greedy and get paid too much. If you agree with that, you're green. 83% of people thought that. That is a very, very scary gap. The trouble with the public's opinion, though, disguised somewhat by these polls, is it's not hugely subtle. And if I go to the fount of all unsubtle views of the public, namely the Daily Mail, here are is a selection of headlines as a result of the search on the word hypocrisy. And you know what? Most people in the country think that most politicians, most leaders are hypocrites. That's a scary position for us to be in, and it doesn't bode well for leadership going forward. Hypocrisy, false representation, is a serious, serious charge in any circumstance. But is it really hypocrisy? Is that a fair analysis, or is that too crude? Well, I first began to ponder this question a long time ago when I listened to, and you'll all remember this, and the students won't, because they weren't alive then probably, but the rest of us will remember it, an astonishing speech by Michael Portillo to a group of students in Southampton University when he said this, basically, if you're British, you've earned your academic qualification, and if you're a foreigner, there's a high risk you just bought it. Pretty insulting remark. It actually rebounded on him quite badly at the time. But I pondered on that because, you know, the only thing that I've got in common with Michael Portillo, and that's Diane Abbott there on the left, and funnily enough, she and I have this in common as well, is that we're all Masters of Arts of Cambridge University, i.e. we all spent something between £5 and £15 to get our master's degree. And we're all British, therefore we didn't get them from a foreign university. So I pondered all that time ago. So does he not know he bought his degree? Well, the answer is, I don't think Michael Portillo is a liar. And so I deduced back then he couldn't have realised it. Obviously, that was just something in his life that he'd forgotten about, blanked out, didn't matter. So he wasn't, I would argue, being hypocritical when he made that statement. He just had forgotten, genuinely, that he'd bought one of his degrees. Unless, of course, his college they're bought for him. But that doesn't affect the point. So back then, I realised there were two different things at play here. There's true hypocrisy, which is when you know that what you say and what you do are incompatible. And then there's what I'm calling double standards, which is when you what you say and what you do are not compatible, but you haven't realised it, the Portillo effect. And what I want to do is to look at these two examples of ENRC and IPSA, two lab experiments, to examine these two concepts a little bit more deeply. For those of you who like a bit of drama, let me assure you now, in both laboratories, I was the frog. So I've ended up being dissected in both experiments. Let me start with ENRC, Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation, a ferrochrome miner from Kazakhstan. It was coming to London, it came to London and listed, raised a huge amount of money, billions of dollars, on the market to dig ferrochrome out of the ground in Kazakhstan. Initially, Kazakhstan is lucky in having most of the periodic table under its surface and therefore has an enormous future in natural resources. And they, but they need, obviously, a capital intensive need to raise capital. The center of the world's international capital is the city of London, so they rightly came here. Do you care? Well, yes, you do care, because when something comes into the FTSE 100, it's an element of your pension. So whether or not you care about the financial services industry and its general contribution to the UK, we all, or most of us, have a personal interest in the success of the FTSE 100. The trouble for ENRC was that it came from Kazakhstan. And I'm embarrassed to say that even I wasn't quite sure where Kazakhstan was when I was asked whether I would join the board. But more importantly, perhaps, I know what's gone through your mind when I say the word Kazakhstan. And this used to annoy intensely the Kazakhs until they realized that it might be a better publicity plan if they went with it rather than against it. But the cultural learnings of America for make benefit glorious nation of Kazakhstan is sort of the way that this country is portrayed, certainly in America and in the UK. Now, for those of you who've seen the film Borat, and I must admit, in preparation for this, I did watch it for the first time. I managed to get halfway through, for I felt so ill, I stopped watching it. But there is an amazing scene, which I would commend to all of you, when Borat stands in a rodeo somewhere in the deep south of America and says things like, George Bush should drink the blood of all Muslims. And he gets a standing ovation from all the people. And then he sings what he purports to be the national anthem of Kazakhstan, which mainly says their potassium deposits are better than those in Uzbekistan. And the Americans then boo him off the stage. And it's nothing to do with double standards, but it is a reminder that irony is not a particularly strong or alive and well facet in America. But I digress. This is about double standards and not about the absence of irony on the other side of the Atlantic. So I wonder how many of you know where Kazakhstan is. Let me help you out. I've marked it there in red in the middle of the picture for those of you who find geography a challenging subject or not a subject at all, but that's a debate for another time. And I've and tragically, thanks to Microsoft, the UK has been moved into the middle of Germany. Now, that actually raises some quite interesting geopolitical questions, but not for today. But I now I'm glad that Steve Ballmer is leaving Microsoft too. The reason I've highlighted the UK is so you can get some sense that it's rather embarrassing to not know where Kazakhstan is, as it's about 12 times the size of the UK. It's actually larger than Western Europe, and it sits perfectly poised between China and Russia. So the work of ENRC was to dig ferrochrome out of the ground and ship it to Russia or to China, depending on where the price was better. And that was the job, and that was the argument for why they came to London to raise the capital to make those things happen. But back to Kazakhstan for a moment. Kazakhstan is a really interesting country. It's got the periodic table. It's got only 15 million people. It was under the yoke of communism until 1991. It has a very, very strong leader in Nazarbayev. And one of the things that attracted me to Kazakhstan and the story when I was contemplating my due diligence before joining this board was this unbelievably dry speech, which is not by Borat, but it genuinely is from Kazakhstan, which is an extract from a speech given by their president to their people. But what matters here is right at the top, the second line, Kazakhstan's strategy of joining the world's 50 most competitive countries. Now, there are about 200 countries in the world, so that's top quartile stuff. That's a pretty, pretty aggressive objective for a country which until 1991 was under the yoke of communism. I want to return to that later, but I want you to remember that point. It makes Kazakhstan, I think, a deeply attractive country if you believe in free trade and commerce and so on. I'm a man of the City of London, and I do believe in free trade and commerce, as does the city. And so what you find, if you study the city's behavior towards, for example, Kazakhstan, is we will spare no effort to go there to tell the Kazakhs how welcome they are to come to our country, to float their companies, to pay enormous amounts of fees to our expertise, and to raise capital in the market. This is one page that talks about David Wootton, Sir David Wootton, who was just the last Lord Mayor before this one, who went on a delegation to Kazakhstan to give precisely those messages. Here is one of his predecessors, the Right Honourable Ian Luder, meeting the mayor of Astana on the left, shaking hands with the chief executive of ENRC on the right. And I, just because if you were Kazakh and were trying to understand anything that happens in our country, dressed in his male robes, walking sheep across a bridge in London, which has nothing to do with anything else I wanted to say other than to remind everybody here that we can be as bizarre as anybody else in the world. So I think the reality of Kazakhstan from the outside was fantastic. It's really interesting, it's inspiring. An objective to be in the top 50 countries within the 15-year plan. So I went on my first visit to Kazakhstan, hugely exciting. It's a massive place, as you saw. It's largely the steppes, if you remember back to your O-level geography, big flat lands, horses running wild, not a lot else happening there, lots of holes in the ground, digging expensive stuff out of it and shipping it to Russia or to China. And the history of the Soviet era was everywhere. So this is a photograph I took in a factory. You don't see art like this in the Western world anymore, although when I was a salesman at IBM in the 70s, there were still a few British factories that had pictures and murals and things like this on the wall. I got to go down underground to see what ferrochrome looks like in the raw. But the most exciting bits for me, Nikki was kind enough to remind you, I did briefly study natural sciences, was the smelting shop. I tell you what, going in these kinds of places and the explosive factory is really, really exciting. And everything that one did there was sort of a James Bond set. So there was this sense of energy and drive to take a country which had been occupied and suppressed and make it into a modern country. So that's Lab 1. Let's just visit Lab 2 now. Lab 2 is the British Westminster parliamentary system and the great era of expenses scandal. Now, we've begun to forget how awful it was as we led up to 2007 and the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority's creation. Although, here's a flavour of the headlines just to remind you of what was happening all of the time in our unbelievably sophisticated, massively democratic country. And what I did, I managed to find a clip from Question Time from that era, which is 3 minutes long, just goes to remind us of what it was like, just the anger that we had in the country at the time. There's a homework assignment coming at the end of what I have to say to you this evening, and one of the questions I won't be asking is, did you think that Mingus Campbell was answering the question that the lady posed at the beginning? It makes me so angry just to watch that film, as I've had to 4 or 5 times getting Microsoft to accept it in this PowerPoint presentation, because we had sunk to such a low ebb in our country in terms of trust, as the word came out there, but the answer was independence. And the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, with 5 worthy board members, Professor Sir Ian Kennedy, an eminent lawyer at the top, Lord Justice Scott Baker retired, High Court judge, man who sent Jonathan Aitken to prison, so he's got form on the bottom. Jackie Barrett, ex-Liberal Democrat MP, and Isabel Sharp, Professor Isabel Sharp, senior lady at Deloitte, and Professor of Accounting in Edinburgh, and yours truly. And I just want you to think for a moment before I go on to what else I want to say, how, if you were sitting in Astana, capital of Kazakhstan, you would have viewed that Question Time debate, that Question Time discussion. And would you have been able to interpret the anger of that man who asked the second question and understand just how angry the people of the country were about what was happening? This is our comfortable, civilized, leafy nation, remember? That's how low we had sunk. But independence, independence, independence. And it was enshrined in the first letter of the name of the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority. Let's go back to Astana for a minute. This is Astana. So remember, this was a country which had not a lot before the wall came down and has now spent a great deal of its wealth on creating railways and roads and airports and cities en route to becoming, they hope, one of the top 50 competitive countries. My first visit there was, so you saw me going down mines and so on, but most of the time I spent in places like this. My first visit there was really uplifting, and I got to have the privilege of a meeting with the Minister of Justice. If we get time after my lecture, I can tell you about the meeting I had with Jack Straw, but that's another subject. Let me just focus on their Minister of Justice. Their Minister of Justice is Zagipa Balieva, lovely lady, been a senior Communist Party official for a long time. There she is with the President on the left-hand side. And she was totally charming. We sat in her office, we talked about floating. This was their second big company, but the bigger of the two, floating it in London, what the impact had been like for them. And I said, because it matters to me a lot, because the competitiveness of the UK and the city in particular matters to me a lot, why did you choose to float in London? And she said, well, there were several reasons. She said, first of all, I did an internship in a law firm in London, so I'm familiar with the system and the country. She said, secondly, we have very good ties. The city people come out and tell us every year how important we are and so on, and we like that. That's special to the UK. And she said, but actually, Mr. Lewis, it doesn't matter why. We've chosen London. Now, you know what? I'm a salesman from training. That's all you need to know. It's now just a question of building on from there. And she said, and you know, we've got a lot to learn from the UK. Now, I'm British. There's a Pavlovian switch inside me called patronising git switch. And when people say that, I suddenly hear myself saying, well, dear lady, if there's ever anything that I can tell you about my country, I would be delighted. And you know, as I'm here with you now, perhaps now will be a good moment. And she said, well, there is. I said, well, dear lady, I can't tell you. This is such a propitious moment. What is it? She said, well, you know, I've asked this of several people, Mr. Lewis, but none as eminent as you. Oh, dear lady, none as eminent as you. She said, and they've all given me the same answer, but I struggle to believe it. I said, well, what is it? And I know she's going to ask me something like, do you really always drive on the left or something charming like that? And she said, well, I'm told you don't have a written constitution. Ah, oh, you have to say, ah. Oh. No, dear lady, you have to understand, written constitutions are for things like people like you. We, of course, don't need those. She fortunately didn't at that time go on, although I had a row with a colleague in the airport subsequently, go on to say, because this was some years ago, and you know, in our country, in Kazakhstan, we have a free and fair election and we vote Nazarbayev in because he's leading us to be one of the 50th most competitive countries in the world. And I gather in your country that your prime minister was selected by the Labour Party, Mr. Brown, and then he was confirmed in post by the hereditary head of state. And yet you're a democracy. No written constitution, party selects the... It's very interesting. Anyway, fortunately, she didn't press her advantage, and I was able to escape only on the written constitution point. But I make that point as a build-out to a later issue I want to say, to where we just take it for granted that what we do all the time must be right and therefore better until challenged. And when the challenge comes, we then decide whether we're hypocrites or practitioners of double standards. But back to ENRC and the laboratory experiment. Unfortunately, ENRC is a very sad story for lots of reasons. You'll be relieved to know far too many to go into this evening, but it did not go well. The early days were fantastic. Shares traded, roared away to premium, to the mining index. Profits were made, money was made, capital was raised, new holes were dug, assets were acquired abroad, outside Kazakhstan. And we then fell on our face by buying something in Africa, in the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. It was a license that we bought, and that license had been taken away, confiscated by the government of DRC from another company. And this other company, First Quantum, decided, as they lost the license, they got nothing to lose, they weren't doing anything in DRC, to attack ENRC as having ordered a Porsche to be stolen. And they submitted, I believe, a 40-page dossier to every newspaper in the UK, accusing ENRC of heinous crimes. And ENRC, as a Kazakh-centered business, didn't respond well. There was a full-page article in the Sunday Times coruscating us for what we'd done. Wrongly so, but doesn't matter, it's in the Sunday Times. And when we had the emergency board meeting as a result, and the Brits said, this is a real problem, we need to have a robust refutation of this immediately, the Kazakhs and others on the board said, what is your problem, you British people? It's one newspaper article in one day, in one week, in one year, in our lifetime. Get over it. And we said, no, it's not. It's the Sunday Times. It's only one step worse than being in the FT. It's as close to being a fact as you can be. There's obviously something going on in Britain, they said, that we don't understand, that matters to you, red-faced, shouting people in the board, and you know what, just get over it. It took us 2 weeks to persuade the management of the company that we needed to respond, and 2 weeks is a lifetime, those of you who have ever been involved in PR, in refuting a bad news story. Our champion for going out to do that was the now Chancellor of Brunel University, the former chairman of GlaxoSmithKline, a man whose reputation is unassailable, whose probity is unquestionable. You talk about trust, Richard Sykes is the most trustworthy person of people. Didn't make any difference at all. He went around newspapers, journalists, talking to people, it made no difference. We'd lost the argument, fundamentally, that we had not done something unbelievably heinous and dodgy. And then it went from bad to worse. The Brits complained more and more, we became irritating to the rest of the board, the rest of the board hated us, the oligarchs, the founders who owned a big slug of the company decided we were part of the problem, and Sykes and I were famously fired at an AGM. Now, interestingly, Nikki was very kind in the introduction to me. She talked about some of the things that I've achieved in my life. One of the records of which I'm particularly proud is I am the first ever non-executive director of a FTSE 100 company to be fired at an AGM. And Richard Sykes is the second. And the only reason for that is that S follows O. And the resolutions are in alphabetical order. And I coined this now famous line, more so than City, to describe that approach to the press, the way things were handled, the way the voting was handled in the AGM, etc., etc. And I discovered I'd become a national, maybe not hero at that point, but certainly a national figure of something or other. And More Savior Than City, if you were ever to Google it, has thousands and thousands of references. It's become one of those great catchphrases in life. Wasn't one of my objectives in joining that board or being fired from it, but never mind. In fact, it's done so well that I've now trademarked it. And if anybody would like to buy anything of my memorabilia with More Savior Than City on, let me know after what I want to say. So that's the other laboratory. We've got laboratory one is IPSA, laboratory two is ENRC. How did the city react to the end of ENRC? Well, they continued to snigger about Kazakhstan. Here's an article relatively recently from from Guy Chazan in the Financial Times, and it's a big thing about the state sovereign fund of Kazakhstan, and I've blown up the quote at the bottom there so you can see it, because they're saying, you know what, it's a dodgy country, governance is useless, they can't manage anything at all, and for example, an issue in Kazpost wiped out the profits of Kazpost for 4 years. You can see that there. Funny enough, the moat in my brother's eye is never really well reported in the city, because not very far apart in time was this article about the day of reckoning for European banks. And you'll notice there that the UK's Lloyds Banking Group, just for mis-selling PPI alone, is £8 billion. That's how much it's cost them. Now, I would say that was a governance mistake of enormous proportions. That's not buying an asset in Africa. That's ripping off your customers and then being fined and having to pay back £8 billion. But actually, in the financial services world, it's what we call a banking mistake unit, because more recently, JP Morgan have agreed to pay £8 billion, $13 billion, for having messed up their customers in the mortgage fraud in America. Board of JP Morgan is untouched. They're the same people. There's no great thing. No More Savior Than Cities. Nobody's been fired. No Richard Sykes has to do anything. Jamie Dimon is still chairman and chief executive. No change at all. Because somehow, when the city looks at financial services institutions, it has a different lens from the lens that it uses to look at, for example, Kazakhstan. So I draw a breath for a moment there and switch back to getting angry about British politicians. IPSA came into being back 2000, well, just before the last election. We managed to get a system in place up and running in time for the election. We had 5 months to do it, an IT system. This caused enormous issues in Parliament. Why do we have to put things in on computers? Why can't we just fill in pieces of paper and submit it? This year, as you know, if you're a benefits claimant, you have to submit your benefit claims on a computer. You don't have any choice. You also don't have £150,000 for two staff members, an office, or any of the other things that an MP gets. But somehow, the difference between being a benefit claimant and being an MP and that not being right is, again, a discontinuity, a discrepancy that is either known or not known by the people arguing it. But let me go back to when IPSA was founded. We put the system in place. We rushed to make sure that the damage that had been done to the UK that was described by the Speaker as being greater than the damage done to Parliament by the German bombs in the Second World War was behind us. We put in place a system, ho-hum, that looked just like the expenses system that anybody else who claims expenses knows about. And I would have expected a wave, and we all did, a wave of gratitude from members of Parliament whose lives had been saved, particularly the new intake, who came in untainted from the past and didn't have to defend anything that happened. The image that I like to cite for what happened for us was this one, and you'll all remember when that US airplane landed on the Hudson River. Imagine those are members of Parliament standing on the wings of that plane. If they complained while they were standing there to US Air that their feet were getting wet, that they were cold, that they were slightly worried, that would perhaps have seemed churlish, given that the pilot had managed to save all of their lives and land safely on the river. Admittedly, if US Air had said this was such a great publicity stunt, why don't we do it more often, perhaps they could have been criticised for that. And IPSA got a few things wrong at the beginning because we were in a hurry, and we immediately said we got a few things wrong and we fixed them immediately. So we stopped landing in the Hudson River. I don't recall a single MP ever saying, you know what, you saved my life and my reputation. In fact, quite the opposite. What we got was lots and lots of people attacking us all of the time. And I became, well, I got a reputation because I was the one of the five of us who was prepared to go into the media to talk about it, known as I was the lightning rod for the arguments. And I got into lots of trouble for accusing MPs of whinging. They were whinging. Saying that it was nonsense that they said they had to sleep on their desks. It was nonsense. We were giving them an allowance to sleep in hotels or taxis to go home. So it was nonsense. But they just said all these things as if they were true. Hypocritical, double standards. We'll return to that in a moment. One of the worst people, in my measure, was a chap called Adam Affrier, the MP for Windsor, who managed to get a committee together to investigate the operation of the Parliamentary Standards Act, i.e. the one that had put us in place, to find out, to find ways of softening the system. He would disagree with that analysis. However, I don't care about that disagreement. What I care about is what he had to say here. In his report, he said, our purpose in this report is not to question the independent regulation of the system of payments to MPs. Paragraph 3. Bearing under paragraph 204, he then said, as you can read there, that if IPSA does not act, then we will take action using primary legislation to change it. Now, call me old-fashioned, call me a student of the English language, but if independence means independence, it cannot be independence with a threat to be dependent if you won't behave the way the people with the threat are offering. And he lost the motion in the House of Commons because the government, in a rare show of courage, opposed the motion, despite its popularity amongst MPs, pointed out the illogicality of his argument, and they defeated the motion on the algebraic illogicality in front of us. Remember Mingus Campbell? Independence, independence, independence. Bracket, not. Anyway, finishing off that laboratory experiment, I then found myself in a fight with the Speaker. This is quite a scary moment in life. He tampered with the appointment process for members of IPSA, which had been independent completely. Three of the great and the good, a High Court judge, an auditor, and a civil service commissioner, recruited commissioned a recruitment agency. They did a search, they found us, long list, short list, names to the Speaker, names from the Speaker, untouched the House of Commons, untouched the House of Commons after a debate, to the House of Lords, untouched by the House of Lords, to the Queen, royal warrant, bingo. Independent, independent, independent. When our terms came up for reappointment, the Speaker added in a member of his committee, i.e. a serving MP. He added in a former MP. He added in the right for the Speaker to interview the candidates, etc. We said, well, this isn't fair, this is not independent, we don't like it, and we refused to apply for our jobs, and we ended up standing down. But we never actually got into dialogue with the Speaker. And then this great opportunity came up when I got to a meeting with him to talk about pay and pensions as part of the consultation. And I said to our chairman, I am going to raise this tampering with the process with the Speaker. Please don't, said Ian Kennedy. I said, no, I'm going to. He said, it would be helpful if you didn't, because you're leaving anyway, you're going to be replaced, let's not make it any more complicated. I said, no, I am the man I am, I have to raise it. So we go to this meeting with the Speaker, we spend 44 minutes with him going on and on and on about pay and pensions, whatever he was doing, and I'm trying to find my moment to get him to ask the question. In comes a flunky and says, Mr. Speaker, your next people are here, I've got to do it now or never. My heart is going inside, and I think I have to do it, because I've said I'm going to do it. If I don't do it now, I should be known as a whiz for all time in this universe. So I said, Mr. Speaker, could you please tell me, could you just give me your assessment of the job that IPSRA has done in our 3 years? And he said, yes. I'm going to summarise a much longer answer because his answers are extremely long. But he said, yes, I think you've done a good job, a creditable job, in very, very difficult circumstances. Damn, I thought, no opportunity for a fight here. And then he said, except, if I may say so, Mr. Lissa, not helped at all by the remarks that you have made in the press, which demonstrate your complete and utter lack of understanding of parliamentary process. I was uncharacteristically speechless. I watched my chairman, Ian Kennedy, flying past me at the throat of the speaker, and a huge row then erupted, subsequently following correspondence between the speaker and myself, which ended up with a fantastic article in the Daily Telegraph, the headline of which was John Bercow and his bullies bring shame on our parliament. Now, the good news is, that went my way. The bad news is, yes, here I am yet again, fired from high office, having stood on a matter of what I thought was huge principle. I want to link those two laboratories, if I can now, to make the point. And here's an extract from a debate. You won't be able to read it very well, and you don't expect to read it all. It's a Cambridge lecture, you just have to take notes on it. But here you are. It's a debate in the House of Commons on December the 20th, 2011. Two MPs, MP1, says, I want to talk about IPSRA and ENRC. Now, you would never have thought you'd be able to link these two other than via me. He goes on to say that, as you can see up there, that the DRC is a terribly corrupt place. The president, in some places where he stood for election in the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, polled more than 100% of the votes. MP number two pops up and says, alternative vote system, no doubt, ho, 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 sits down again, he carries on and on, and then suddenly manages to link ENRC to IPSA and then to me. Now, I have to tell you, it's a slightly scary feeling reading about yourself in Hansard, having been, in this case, slandered by a member of parliament. It's at the bottom, this piece. In fact, I think I've blown it up to make it a bit easier to read there. So I called out the parliamentary commissioner on standards, nothing to do with us, and said, what can I do about this? And he said, well, not a lot. I'm a salesman. And I said, aha, not a lot. That means I can do something. What can I do? Because this is heinous. And he said, you can write to me. I said, OK. And he said, but I must warn you before you put pen to paper, Ken. Once you've written to me, there's absolutely nothing at all that I can do. So I ended up being slandered by these two people one of them, and supported by his mate in Parliament on December the 20th. It turned into newspaper articles. It had a little bit of life of its own. And then one day my daughter called me up and said, Dad, have you seen the headlines today? Karma has won again. Because the two MPs were Eric Joyce and Dennis McShane. I pass no other comment. I want to move on now to talk about the city and Kazakhstan. But imagine if you were in Kazakhstan, Astana, observing all of that going on. Let's go back to the city, having explained the two laboratories, and despite the moats in our own eyes, and just remind ourselves what happens here. First of all, as far as the FT is concerned, this actually predated the end of the ENRC experience, but it's typical of what was said. Governance learnings of UK for make benefit in ENRC continues to take the mickey out of a trading partner of ours. But our dear Prime Minister is smarter than that, and he went where Lord Mayors have gone before him to persuade Nazarbayev that was a jolly good idea to keep floating businesses, this is this year, to keep floating businesses in London despite what had happened in the city and the city attitude to ENRC. And in doing that, he had to suppress, as the headline reminds us, his concerns about human rights. But he can't do that because he's the British Prime Minister, and so he did in fact raise the issue of human rights with Nazarbayev. I'm not sure we've got it. Yes, the second paragraph, the bottom paragraph, Nazarbayev was stony-faced, underscoring the political risks of Cameron's strategy, et cetera, of broadening trade links. So Cameron gets the importance of trade and the importance of the city. Whoopee. However, whether he understands the importance of human rights is a different issue. And if you were Nazarbayev sitting back there in your palace in Astana and you realise that we are trying to get out of, or the Prime Minister says we should get out of the Convention on Human Rights, for human rights reasons, it's again, well, is that hypocrisy or is that merely an example of double standards? Let me close off the laboratory experiment and race to a conclusion here by saying the first thing that's worth noting in the last World Economic Forum report on competitive nations in the world, guess what? Kazakhstan has made it to number 50. Now, it's worth a question in your homework assignment, which is, while he was doing that with a clear vision of where he was trying to take his country, what were we doing? What was the British vision of where we were trying to take our country from 1991 or 2001? I leave that question hanging in the air and come back to this point about that single dimension that I introduced at the beginning, the difference between hypocrisy when you know that what you're saying and what you're doing is incompatible with double standards when you don't realise that what you're saying and what you're doing are incompatible. But I came to realise that's an insufficient definition. It's a useful dimension, necessary but not sufficient, because there's another one, and I've tried to give you some examples of both sides of this spectrum, which is that some people are unbelievably intelligent and some people aren't. And you can't apply the same criticism to somebody who's not very bright but is not being consistent. And so I want to separate these two concepts of hypocrisy and double standards by dividing it in these other two dimensions of actual intelligence rather than intent, although there's a debate about whether it's intent or not, and say there are now four states in the hypocritical and double standards universe, and the people who practice them have simple labels. If you are not very bright but unbelievably convinced that you are right about things, even though it's incompatible, you are, of course, a bigot. I won't walk you through all the squares, you get the general point. Now, if the person who's leading your nation or your organization is on this Boston grid, you need to worry how you're going to deal with them, because there is not much point in wasting your time trying to persuade a bigot to change his or her mind. But I'm arguing controversially today, I suspect, that it's not all lost. There are some people redeemable. People with intelligence who just haven't spotted the fact, like my constitution point from before, that what they're saying and what they think and what they're doing are not compatible. So I want to spend my last minutes on the, is it possible to redeem people who are bright but have not realized they are behaving totally inconsistently? That's not a hypocrite, because they are capable of being convinced. They haven't realized it, they're capable of being convinced. And I want to come back to my time here, my very happy time here at Cambridge, in the second tripos under which I studied. Thank you, Master, for pointing this out, the social and political science tripos. And the lecturer then, Professor Leach, some of you will have studied under him, I'm sure, an expert in structuralism, Malinowski, etc., the provost of kings at the time. I remember going to my first lecture he spoke at down in town, and he was a very impressive man, both by reputation and in figure, and he was wearing his gown, and we were sitting there. It was hugely exciting for me, because I had a year in natural sciences, where all the people in all the lessons, all the lectures, and all the labs were men, largely wearing school clothes, because they'd gone straight up to university, and suddenly there was a mixed gender group of people in this theater. So I remember sitting there thinking, changing tripods was a really, really smart move, Ken. But in came this man. He walked straight out of the board, didn't say anything, and wrote on the board, "Love is like a red, red rose," R. Burns. And all the girls in the lecture theatre wrote, "Love is like a red, red rose," R. Burns, and the date and everything. And all the men thought, well, at least there are some girls here to look at, and this lecture's got another 38 minutes to go. And then he wrote, "Love is like a green, green cabbage," Trowbridge and Islander. And everybody burst out laughing. And he swept round, I remember, in his gown and said, "Why are you laughing?" Nobody laughed. He said, I asked, "Why are you laughing?" People started saying, "It wasn't me, it was him, sir. He was laughing." And he said, "Why is it that you think that to compare the most pure of emotions to vegetable matter of a red colour is somehow superior to somebody who compares the most pure of emotions to vegetable matter of a green colour?" I remember sitting there thinking, you know, every now and again in one's learning, there's a profound moment. So I've got no idea why I thought a rose was okay and a cabbage was stupid, but I shall certainly laugh more carefully in Professor Leach's lectures going forward. My argument, quite simply, is that redemption comes from people being intelligent enough to realise the incompatibility, the inconsistency of what they're doing, and then to do something about it. The Professor Leach lecture, that particular one which had such a profound effect on me, ended up with him drawing a comparison between the Archbishop of Canterbury and a Trowbridge Island medicine man. I couldn't find the original picture, but this is rather similar to the one that he had. And he dissected the two men. Bone through the nose. Well, the Archbishop of Canterbury doesn't have it through his nose, but he is in fact wearing a relic made of bone from a saint from the 7th century. The hat, he went through point by point by point in that lecture. By the time he'd finished, the two men were identical. And I remember thinking, you know what, I've been trained in Britain and the way I've been brought up to laugh at primitive people and to respect what I consider to be sophisticated people. Actually, they're people. And they've got many, many similarities, which is, of course, a structuralist argument. And I flatter myself that I was intelligent enough and well-taught enough to realise the difference between that arrogant assumption that I must be right because it's what I've always believed and having that unpacked by somebody who showed the weakness of my argument. I feel that I was redeemable and somewhat redeemed. Your homework assignment, then, is to play a game and to take these six men and to pop them onto the squares as you see fit. And take my advice, ladies and gentlemen, this evening, unless they're on the red square, avoid them like the plague. Thank you very much.